earlier that day and seemed to think that was enough. The only help Porter got later came in the form of patronizing encouragement. "If the enemy are retiring and you are a chasseur, pitch in," McClellan told him. Later, still clueless about what was happening, he urged Porter, "Try to drive the rascals and take some prisoners and guns." McClellan, closeted at headquarters and out of touch with both fronts, had apparently lost the will to command. He would no longer consider launching an attack of any sort. He simply awaited whatever Lee had in store for him and dreamed only of getting his army safely to Harrison's Landing. At about 5 p.m., Lee caught up with Jackson, who was dutifully following Lee's morning instructions, and who, in obeying his orders to move to Old Cold Harbor, supposedly well behind the Union lines, had in fact landed not far from the Union right. Lee, who must have understood that Jackson's pointless march was a result of his own mistake, nonetheless seemed impatient. Jackson was commanding more than half his army. Lee needed all of that army in the fight, and he needed it right away. The two generals met on Telegraph Road, less than a mile from the fight at Boson Swamp. Jackson, as usual, looked nothing like a general. According to one of Jeb Stuart's soldiers, who saw Jackson a bit earlier in the afternoon, his coat was positively scorched by the sun. The cap of the general matched the coat. The sun had turned it quite yellow indeed, and it tilted over the wearer's forehead so far as to make it necessary for him to raise his chin in looking at you. He rode in his peculiar forward-leaning fashion, his old raw-boned sorrel gaunt and grim, moving about slowly and sucking a lemon, one of a few recorded instances of this. He had rather the air of a spectator. Lee greeted Jackson warmly, while soldiers around them erupted into loud cheers and rebel yells, and then offered what has sounded to many historians like a mild rebuke. "Ah, General, I'm glad to see you. I had hoped to be with you before." Jackson mumbled something in reply that bystanders could not hear. Lee then turned for a moment toward the sounds of the battle. "That fire is very heavy," he said. "Do you think your men can stand it?"
"They can stand almost anything," Jackson replied. "They can stand that."
Lee gave him new orders. Jackson then saluted and galloped away, his eyes alight with the prospect of battle after so much dreary marching. Jackson, who had seemed bleary-eyed and lethargic all day, was now full of fire and resolve. Robert Dabney commented that he'd only seen this sort of tempest of passion on his face 3 times in his Civil War career. He issued orders to his commander to press the attack. Finally, he was engaged. With Jackson in hand, Lee was now ready to launch the massive attack he had been working on all afternoon, during which time the fighting had raged on and he had taken heavy losses. It was very likely his largest single attack of the war. There was nothing piecemeal about it this time. He had managed to bring roughly 32,000 men forward along a curving 2-mile front against Porter's entrenched 34,000. At 7 p.m., Lee sent them forward. What followed was some of the roughest fighting of the war, as long rolls of musket fire and billows of white smoke swept across the long bluff, and Union cannon pounded canister into the graybacks as they came forward. The butchery was shocking, even for men who were getting used to it. "Never before did I see so many dead men," wrote one soldier. "Such a scene of carnage, men with no arms, some without legs, others with part of their heads off, some with their bowels out. The smell of blood mingled with the smell of black powder." Just before dark, Porter's lines, exhausted after repelling attacks for 8 hours, broke in 2 places. Perhaps the most spectacular drive was that of a 32-year-old Kentuckian and former Indian fighter named John Bell Hood, commanding the 4th Texas Brigade, containing Georgians and some South Carolinians, in Chase Whiting's division under Jackson's command. Just before the final attack, Lee rode up to Hood and asked, "Can you break this line?" Hood said he would try.
"May God be with you,"
Lee shouted, lifting his hat as he rode away.
Hood's men then moved forward at the quick step, without pausing to fire, through what Confederate Colonel Evander Law called a withering storm of lead and iron. They passed through and over dead and wounded men, mangled horses, and busted wagons. They fell by the score, victims of canister and enfilading fire from most of the left side of the Union lines. Hood took 1,000 casualties. At 100 yards, they broke into a run, erupting into the full, high-pitched, whirring scream of the rebel yell, which sounded to Longstreet's men like the noise made by 40,000 wildcats. Across the swamp they came, and up the rise, and suddenly they had broken through to the artillery. Just as suddenly, the Union defenses, which had held solidly through attack after attack, began to break. Though Hood became the battle's most visible hero, it would turn out later that brigades from D.H. Hill's James Longstreet divisions had broken through at about the same time. But that didn't matter anymore. The Union retreat had begun. The battle was soon over. In 7 hours' fighting, over possession of a swamp and the bluff that rose above it, the Union sustained 6,000 casualties and the Confederates 9,000. On an hourly basis, Gaines' Mill was one of the war's costliest battles. The ratio is predictable for a force attacking such a strong defensive position. The very capable Fitz John Porter, with a single corps plus a division, had held off most of Lee's army for 7 hours. But in the end, it had been Lee's battle, his first great victory, against a worthy opponent on the opponent's chosen field of combat. He and he alone had managed the victory. Jackson, in a subordinate position, was just another battlefield commander. He performed adequately. He followed orders. He had no special role in the final attack, and in fact it was Lee, not Jackson, who had ordered the latter's divisions into place. That night, Jackson went to the tent of his new friend, Jeb Stuart, woke him, and the two men sat on blankets and talked of the next day's work. Jackson observed that Gaines's Mill was the most terrific fire of musketry I've ever heard. During that night came the results of that musket fire, the screams and moans of the wounded and dying rising from the swamps, woods, and fields. McClellan took the defeat at Gaines's Mill hard. The invincibility he thought he had glimpsed had vanished in the white smoke of its musket fire, as had whatever confidence he had left. And in its place came only heartache and bitterness that his outnumbered men had been so wantonly sacrificed. Even though he himself had been miles from the battlefield, sequestered in his headquarters office, here at last was a real, palpable, verifiable threat— a rampaging Confederate army of untold numbers, with Stonewall Jackson in its midst, a reason to run as fast as he could to his new base. He called a meeting of his commanders that evening, told them about his plan for retreat, and got their support for the plan by selling them on the magnitude of the Confederate threat. Not all of his generals agreed. Division commanders Joseph Hooker and Phil Kearny were indignant when they learned of the decision. They had been watching ever more skeptically the amateur theatrics of General Magruder in front of Richmond, and were fully convinced that rebel strength there was a sham. They knew how vulnerable Richmond was. They were so upset that they pressured their corps commander, Samuel Heitzelman, into taking them, at a late hour, to McClellan, where they made their case for an immediate attack on the city. Heitzelman supported them. McClellan was unmoved. The change of base, the euphemism he insisted on, would take place. Kearny, known for his hair-trigger temper, exploded at McClellan, denouncing him, according to a staff officer who was there, in language so strong that all who heard it expected he would be placed under arrest until a general court-martial could be held, or at least he would be relieved of his command. Actually, the retreat was already underway. Mack had ordered Erasmus Keyes and his Fourth Corps to begin retreating through White Oak Swamp toward Harrison's Landing. The rest of the army, 100,000 men, 300 pieces of artillery, 4,000 wagons, tens of thousands of horses, and 2,500 cattle, would soon be in motion. McClellan did something else that night, too. Shortly after midnight, feeling bitter and despondent and abandoned by his government, which had once again failed to send him the troops he needed. He sent one of the war's most infamous telegrams to Secretary of War Stanton. He told Stanton of the desperate battle he had not witnessed and its outcome. Then wrote, "I've lost this battle because my force was too small. I again repeat that I am not responsible for this, and I say it with the earnestness of a general who feels in his heart the loss of every brave man who has been needlessly sacrificed today. I know that a few thousand men more would have changed this battle from a defeat to a victory. As it is, the government must not and cannot hold me responsible for the result. I feel too earnestly tonight. I've seen too many dead and wounded comrades to feel otherwise than that the government has not sustained this army. If you do not do so now, the game is lost. If I save this army now, I tell you plainly that I owe no thanks to you or any other persons in Washington. You have done your best to sacrifice this army." With those words, accusing the Secretary of War of treason, or something very like it, McClellan must have surely known he was committing career suicide. Or maybe he was so absorbed in his own pathos that he could not see what he was doing. In any case, an enterprising man named Edward S. Sanford, who was head of the War Department's telegraphic office, took it upon himself to remove the final 9 words before delivering the telegraph, thus saving McClellan from himself. Instead of an abrupt dismissal, McClellan received a reasonably sympathetic response from Lincoln in reply. "Save your army at all events. We'll send reinforcements as fast as we can." Once again, Porter's army fled by night from Lee, managing to get all of the roughly 29,000 men he had left across the Chickahominy. Once again, the Confederates awoke to a deserted battlefield and deserted enemy camps, strewn with abandoned supplies. That day, June 28, would see the vaunted Army of the Potomac in full flight southward across the peninsula toward Harrison's Landing. In military terms, McClellan was taking a very large risk. A 100,000-man army, strung out over 15 miles of road, was an exquisitely vulnerable target. All the more so since an entire army would be jammed onto a single road, across a single bridge, through a swamp, with constant jarring stops and starts. It was McClellan's good fortune that Lee faced a version of the same problem Jackson had faced at Winchester. Lee knew the enemy was retreating, but where was it going? On June 28, his army was virtually frozen in place while he tried to figure it out. As Lee saw it, McClellan had 3 options. He could move his army east and cross the Chickahominy to protect his supplies. He could retreat back down the peninsula the way he'd come. Or he could move to the James River. The first thing Lee did was to send Richard Ewell's division and Jeb Stuart's cavalry to White House Landing to find out. They found the railroad unguarded and part of it destroyed. They found tons of supplies in flames. McClellan's old headquarters mansion, the Lee Place, was burning too. The Union had already loaded 3,000 fugitive slaves onto canal boats for evacuation. Though this was the first clear evidence of a general retreat, Lee would not be completely sure until the next morning that the Union Army was headed for the James River. What he did know for certain was that his original plan had worked. By threatening their supply lines, he had levered the Federals out of their trenches and forced them to abandon their planned siege of Richmond. It was his first great stroke of tactical brilliance. But that was only the first step. He now had in his hands, he could see it with startling clarity, the opportunity to capture or destroy a large part of the Union's largest army. He had the chance, perhaps the only time he would ever be given it, to end the war right here. This was not just conjecture. McClellan himself believed it too. An army strung out for 15 miles, with its full supply train, was a case study in vulnerability. Time, of course, was the critical element. Lee had to catch the snake in mid-flight. The plan he concocted for Sunday, June 29, had 2 main elements. First, Major General John B. Magruder, he of the recent theatrics, would advance east from Richmond and engage the Union rear guard, fixing it in place, making it fight, and thus slowing the pace of the retreat. Jackson would rebuild the destroyed bridges on the Chickahominy, then cross the river with his divisions under Chase Whiting, Richard Ewell, D.H. Hill, and himself, and join the fight. Meanwhile, divisions under James Longstreet, A.P. Hill, and Benjamin Huger would swing south and east in an arc whose terminus was at a crossroads called Glendale. If all went according to plan, the following day, the 30th, the Confederate Army would hit McClellan from three directions, Jackson's 24,000 coming down from the north through the White Oak Swamp. And with luck, they would catch enough of it out in the open to deal it a crippling blow. It was, in a sense, a race to Glendale. Like almost every other grand plan Lee made during the 7 days, the one for June 29 did not work as he had anticipated. Once again, Jackson, with 14 of Lee's 35 brigades, was the main victim of the confusion. And, as with the fiasco at Mechanicsville, he has come under sharp criticism over the years for the supposed missteps that resulted from it. Once again, the criticism, focused on his failure to show up at the Battle of Savage's Station that day, was unfair. Jackson again was following Lee's orders. When Jackson met with Lee that morning, he had been given straightforward orders. Repair the Grapevine and Alexander's bridges on the Chickahominy, which Porter's men had destroyed, then cross the river and come to the aid of Magruder in his attack on the Union rear. Jackson proceeded with the first task, completing repairs of the Grapevine Bridge quickly. Unfortunately, he had assigned the other bridge to the incompetent Dabney, who failed and was quickly replaced. Jackson would need both bridges for his corps and ponderous supply train. While he was repairing them, Magruder had launched a lukewarm attack on the Union force near a railroad depot called Savage's Station, but soon became fearful that he was facing a larger force and asked Lee for reinforcements. Jackson, meanwhile, sent a courier to Magruder to tell him that his troops would begin crossing the Chickahominy at about 2 p.m. He was preparing to cross several brigades when, at about 3 p.m., he received new orders in the form of a communique from Lee's adjutant, Colonel R. H. Chilton. The message was addressed to Jeb Stuart, who was still at White House Landing, and read as follows. The general commanding requests that you will watch the Chickahominy as far as Forge Bridge, ascertain if any attempt will be made in that direction by the enemy, advising General Jackson, who will resist their passage until reinforced. Stuart had sent it on to Jackson, who added the following reply. General Ewell will remain near dispatch station, and myself near the present position, and sent it by horseman right back to him. Both the note and Jackson's understanding of it are perfectly clear. He was to guard the lower bridges on the Chickahominy and prevent the enemy from crossing. Why? Because Lee was still not absolutely certain that McClellan would not try to recross the Chickahominy. With the power at his disposal, if he only believed in it, McClellan could still do whatever he wanted, and Lee knew it. But by mid-afternoon, both Lee and Magruder were wondering, where was Jackson? His lateness was getting to be a daily occurrence. Magruder sent a courier to Jackson to find out what was wrong, and Jackson made the problem worse with his clipped, uninformative reply, saying that he could not help Magruder because he had other important duties to perform. By this, he meant guarding the crossings, as Lee had ordered him to do. But the note's almost insolent brevity enraged Magruder, who could not imagine what could be more important than coming to his assistance. Though Lee insisted to Magruder that he had ordered Jackson to cross and fight, blame for the misunderstanding must rest squarely on either Lee or his adjutant, Chilton. Lee, if he wrote the order, and Chilton if he sent something to Stuart other than what Lee had told him to. Once again, Jackson and his 24,000 men were prevented from engaging in combat. Magruder managed to mount a tepid attack in late afternoon, bringing 14,000 of his men against 16,000 Union troops under Major General Edwin Sumner. The advance soon burned itself out. The threat he had posed was so slight at Savage's Station that an entire Union corps under Samuel Heintzelman had slipped away, precisely what Lee had been trying to prevent. Still, the net result in military terms was a Confederate victory. After the battle, Sumner fled south, and what he left behind suggested an army in panicked retreat. 1,000 men who became prisoners, stragglers from the retreating army, and 2,500 sick and wounded. In their haste, they had also left tons of supplies, some only partially destroyed. In Dabney's description, they found all the apparatus of a vast and lavish host. The whole country was full of deserted plunder, army wagons, and pontoon trains partially burned or crippled, mounds of grain and rice, and hillocks of mess beef smoldering, tens of thousands of axes, picks, and shovels, medicine chests with their drugs stirred into a foul medley, overcoats torn from the waist up. For weeks afterward, the agents of our army were busy gathering in the spoils. In one railroad ditch, the discarded molasses ran knee-deep, a symbol just at that moment of the helplessness of the most extravagantly equipped army in history. Jackson's letter home to Anna was that of a victorious general in pursuit of a fleeing enemy. "An ever-kind providence has greatly blessed our efforts and given us great reason for thankfulness in having defended Richmond. Today the enemy is retreating down the Chickahominy towards the James River. Many prisoners are falling into our hands." McClellan's change of base had meanwhile appeared in the newspapers and had quickly become a Confederate joke. "It was a catchword among our fun-loving troops," wrote one soldier in his memoirs, "to signify discomfiture or defeat. If two dogs fought and one ran, the men cheered and shouted, 'Look at him, changing his base.'" In spite of the crossed signals, on the morning of Monday, June 30, Lee still had a clear opportunity to destroy a large part of McClellan's army. The latter had, once again, marched all night. Its lead columns under Erasmus Keyes were already camped on the James River. The rest of the army had just made it across White Oak Swamp and onto the gently swelling plains and woodlands around Glendale, where seven of McClellan's 11 divisions were now camped, 8 to 9 miles from their destination at Harrison's Landing. Lee's scheme to reach Glendale ahead of some of the Union Army had failed, but his basic idea of attack would be the same. 9 divisions would converge in a concentric assault on the retreating Federals. McClellan himself, unaccountably, had chosen this moment to withdraw to the gunboats on the James River, where the head of his army was camped, thus leaving his rear guard to confront the full fury of Lee's army, which he knew was coming. His behavior is difficult, or perhaps impossible, to justify, the more so since later that day he boarded the warship Galena, where he enjoyed dinner with wine with the captain while a major battle was underway. In doing so, he left units from 5 different corps to work out tactical details among themselves. It was as though the exhausted, anxiety-ridden general had again, as he had at Gaines's Mill, temporarily lost the resolve to exercise command. His behavior would be the basis for many later accusations of cowardice and dereliction of duty. "The corps commanders fought their troops according to their own ideas," General Samuel Heintzelman testified later of the fighting that day at Glendale. "We helped each other. If anybody asked for reinforcements, I sent them. If I wanted reinforcements, I sent to others. McClellan was the most extraordinary man I ever saw. I do not see how any man could leave so much to others and be so confident that everything would go just right." Lee, on the other hand, was quite in the middle of things. It was a momentous day. The future of the war and the nation itself was conceivably riding on what his army did, and he was keenly aware of it. He met with Jackson at Savage's Station just after dawn. Jackson had ridden up on Little Sorrel at the head of a large mounted escort, looking as dusty and nondescript as ever. "He sat stark and stiff in the saddle," wrote an observer later. "Horse and rider appeared worn down to the lowest point of flesh consistent with effective service. His hair, skin, eyes, and clothes were all one neutral dust tint. The mangy little cadet cap was pulled so low in front that the visor just cut the glint of his eyeballs. Lee arrived a few moments later, handsome, smartly dressed, and as usual the picture of perfection on horseback. The two generals exchanged a warm greeting, then began to talk animatedly in tones that were just out of hearing of several curious observers. Then one of the two generals, the observers did not agree on which one it was, began to mark off a diagram in the dirt with his boot, talking earnestly all the while. When it was finished, the draftsman, Lee or Jackson, but most probably Lee, in the words of one of the observers, raised his foot and stamped it down and said, this time loud enough to hear, "We've got him." Jackson then mounted his horse and rode away. Lee looked after him for a moment, then rode off too. They did not have him, in the sense that McClellan's forces, like Banks's before Winchester, were deployed in a long line of march. McClellan was too smart for that, marching by night and setting up carefully chosen defensive positions during the day. Lee most likely saw the likelihood or virtual certainty that he would be able to fall on a piece of the army with his larger force. He was right. While he and Jackson had their meeting, 70,000 Confederates were advancing on 55,000 Federals at Glendale. What happened over the next few hours was one of the great missed chances of the war. Lee's plan, even more complex than his scheme for Mechanicsville, required the orchestrated movements of 12,000 men under Benjamin Huger, 20,000 under A.P. Hill and James Longstreet, 13,500 under John Magruder, and 24,000 under Stonewall Jackson. Jackson, with the largest force, would take the same road the Union Army had taken, across White Oak Swamp. The others would come in from the west and attack the Union flank. Under Lee's orders, they were all moving that morning. Jackson's day had started with a miserable night of rain that had soaked him in his bed. He very likely did not sleep at all. Though he was sick and exhausted, he put his army on the march at 3:30 a.m., crossing the Chickahominy River and passing through Savage's Station and its litter of supplies, some of them burning. The march once again was slow, this time in part because his men could not resist loading themselves up with Union discards, coffee, ammunition, clothing, shoes. It took his men 7 hours to cover 5 miles to the bridge at White Oak Swamp, where they arrived at about noon to find the single bridge destroyed. At approximately 2 p.m., Jackson opened an artillery barrage against the Union forces on the high ground south of the swamp and sent his cavalry chief, Thomas Munford, across the deep water to scout the crossing. Munford came under murderous fire and returned. He reported that there would be no possibility of reconstructing the bridge, with William Franklin's 6th Corps and its 19,000 men in artillery sitting atop the bluff on the other side. And there, at the ruins of the White Oak Swamp Bridge, Jackson stalled, never to move again that day. It was the first failure in a string of failures. Jackson was not the only one who failed to advance. Huger's division would be stymied by felled trees on the road, Magruder would spend the day in futile marching and countermarching. Thus Lee could muster only a little more than 20,000 men under Longstreet and A.P. Hill when he finally mounted his attack at 4 p.m. Though the fighting was hard and bloody, and the Confederates breached Union lines once, the Battle of Glendale ended in a stalemate. Following the pattern of the 7 days, the Union force retreated once again by night, this time to a strong position at Malvern Hill, a few miles toward the James River. Never before or after, wrote Porter Alexander, did the fates put such a prize in our reach. Where was Jackson this time? The answer, broadly speaking, was that he was having what appears to be a temporary, though fairly complete, mental and physical breakdown. The description of him as worn down to the lowest point of flesh consistent with effective service conforms to almost all accounts of him that week. He was not himself. He was sick with fever, debilitated, possibly dehydrated. He had had an absurdly small amount of sleep since June 23. Jackson wrote Anna that he had been in a wet bed the night before, in a torrential storm, and had gotten up at midnight. By the time he arrived at White Oak Swamp, he'd probably been in the saddle for 10 hours. Indeed, the old Jackson seemed to disappear altogether that week. Anecdotes about him seem oddly substanceless. He wasn't even indulging in his usual diversion of badgering his own generals. He seemed emotionally drained, too, strangely empty. In a letter to Anna, all he could muster was a formal, colorless, almost pro forma wish. "I do trust that our God will soon bless us with an honorable peace, and permit us to be together at home again in the enjoyment of domestic happiness." Faced with the sharp Union artillery fire, Jackson decided immediately that he would not try to force his way across the swamp. This seemed completely out of character. Though he would have sustained large losses attempting it, he had never been shy about expending blood. He then looked for another way out of the swamp. Tom Munford continued his search downstream and found an undefended crossing. He sent word of this back to Jackson, adding that the Union flank on the other side of this swamp crossing also appeared to be undefended. He heard nothing back, and Jackson never followed up. Though this was only a cow path, as Munford described it, and would present great difficulties for a full army corps to cross, Munford later wrote that "I had seen Jackson's infantry cross far worse places, and I expected that he would attempt it." Jackson's subordinate Wade Hampton, the wealthy South Carolina plantation owner, whose Hampton Legion had fought bravely at Manassas, found yet another crossing, only a quarter mile from the destroyed bridge. Hampton returned and told Jackson that he could quickly build a log bridge for infantry, but not artillery. Jackson ordered him to do it. Several hours later, a serviceable bridge existed that could have put whoever crossed it 150 yards from the unsuspecting Yankees. When Hampton returned to tell Jackson, he found the general seated on a log, quite motionless, with his eyes closed. His cap, as usual, was pulled down to his nose. Hampton gave Jackson his report and volunteered to lead an advance over his new bridge. To Hampton's complete amazement, the general did not speak, nor did he even move. He sat in silence for some time, then rose and walked off in silence. Jackson later was found prostrate and asleep underneath a tree, in spite of the day-long artillery battle that was screaming overhead. He seemed almost perfectly passive. When Longstreet sent an aide to him asking for his help, Jackson replied that he could do nothing. He later fell into such a deep sleep that his aides had trouble waking him. He fell asleep at dinner with a biscuit between his teeth. When he was awakened, he suddenly seemed to come to his senses, saying, "Now, gentlemen, let us at once to bed and rise with the dawn and see if tomorrow we cannot do something." That was little consolation for Lee. Jackson commanded his largest force, and he had failed not only to cross the swamp, but even to distract the Union Army into keeping units in place to watch him. In midday, the threat from Jackson seemed so slight that Union Major General William B. Franklin was able to release 2 brigades, nearly 10,000 men, to help fight Longstreet and Hill. Franklin himself was later critical of his adversary, saying, "It must be evident to any military reader that Jackson ought to have known about Brackett's Ford, only 1 mile above White Oak Bridge, and ought to have discovered the weakness of our defense at that point." Nor had Jackson bothered to contact Lee about this, who was a mere 45 minutes away by courier. Jackson acknowledged none of this in his official report, saying only that the relatively deep swamp, the destruction of the bridge, and the strength of the enemy position prevented crossing. He did, however, react when 2 weeks later he overheard Surgeon Hunter McGuire, aide Sandy Pendleton, and Artillery Chief Stapleton Crutchfield talking about the campaign. When one brought up the subject of why Jackson had not gone to the aid of Longstreet and Hill, Jackson interrupted, "If General Lee had wanted me, he could have sent for me." His statement managed to be both cryptic and accurate.
Lee had never once communicated with Jackson during the day, not to request that he cross the swamp, nor to find out why he had not crossed the swamp. Lee was appalled at the results of the day. "We of General Lee's staff knew at the time that he was deeply, bitterly disappointed," wrote Porter Alexander, "but he made no official report of it and glossed over as much as possible in his own reports. Lee had not yet learned how to wield the full power of his army, how to make it move in concert, how to deal with its sometimes balky or independent commanders. Then again, for all appearances, he had just won another stunning victory, once again driving the Union forces before him. Whatever contretemps there were remained between Confederate generals and their staffs. Few of the rank and file had any idea of who was supposed to be where and doing what, and what opportunities might have been missed. To them, and to the rest of the South, it was all pure rebel glory, vindication of the idea, as Manassas had been, that Yankees were no match for the Confederate fighters. The morning after the battle, Jackson, on horseback, happened upon a group of troops from Magruder's command, most of whom were seeing him for the first time. Such cheering I had never heard before, wrote one Georgia soldier, of the man he called our most famous general. The soldiers went wild as they tossed their caps in the air. As the Army of Northern Virginia pushed the hated Yankees inexorably toward the river, Jackson was a bigger hero than ever. Glendale was not the end of the 7 days, though it should have been. In his disappointment and frustration, mixed with fatigue and sickness that sounded a bit like what Jackson was experiencing, Lee decided he wanted to strike one last time at his enemy before it took shelter under its Navy's guns. He believed the Army of the Potomac was badly demoralized. Evidence of it was everywhere on their marches. Thousands of rifles, knapsacks, blankets, and other supplies strewn randomly on the ground. He would fight yet again on ground of the Union's choosing, and once again it was excellent defensive ground, 1.5 miles long, 0.5 mile wide, gently sloping, amphitheater-like meadow bordered by thick woods, the swamps and ravines on the margins. It was called Malvern Hill. The place was more like a killing field, a defensive position that Fitz John Porter, architect of the fearsome works at Mechanicsville and Gaines's Mill, considered to be the strongest of the campaign by far. The Union advantage started with its artillery. 268 cannons, many of them rifled, plus 26 giant siege guns that McClellan had been preparing to use against Richmond. The guns were everywhere, stacked on the brow of the hill, bristling on the Army's flanks, and even ranged in front of the infantry, where their flesh-shredding canister loads would enjoy a clear field of fire. Around them, stacked to the top of the rise, were the blue masses of infantry, 54,000 of them. The borders of the amphitheater were unassailable. Ravines, swamps, streams, and thick woods meant that the Union troops could not be flanked, which meant that the Confederate attack would be funneled into a narrow front with no cover. The rebel infantry would have to attack the Union position by coming up the rise, straight into the teeth of the strongest artillery emplacement of the war. It sounded like suicide, and Jackson and his brother-in-law D.H. Hill, who formed the Confederate left at the base of the slope, and along with Huger's and Magruder's troops would do the fighting this day, understood this at once. Hill thought it was hopeless, and had warned Lee not to try to fight there. Jackson, who saw no chance for a successful assault, wrote in his battle report, "The enemy in large force were found strongly posted on a commanding hill, all the approaches to which, in the direction of my position, could be swept by his artillery and were guarded by infantry. The nearest batteries could only be approached by traversing an open space of 300 or 400 yards, exposed to the murderous fire of artillery and infantry." The Confederate strategy began with an idea. James Longstreet, looking at the spectacle of raw force arrayed in front of him, had the notion to bring up artillery on the left and right, subject the Federals to a pounding crossfire, and hope that this might have some effect on their apparently ironclad defenses. As a tactical plan, it wasn't much good. In practice, it was a disaster.
Even though Jackson and others tried to bring up batteries quickly, at one point he personally helped haul a North Carolina gun forward, the Confederate guns came up piecemeal and to little effect. They were losing, and losing badly. Soon after the artillery duel started, Jackson sat down on a stump to write a note to Jeb Stuart. While he was writing, a shell from a rifled Parrott gun exploded nearby. Half a dozen men were killed or wounded, and dust and dirt rained over Jackson and his letter. He calmly shook the dirt off the paper and finished his writing. He then stood up, gave directions for the dead and wounded to be carried off, mounted, and rode off. The last words of his letter were, "I trust that God will give our army a glorious victory." He could not have been more wrong. For the Union gunners, the battle was more like a large-scale turkey shoot. Whenever a Confederate battery would unlimber, the massed Union guns would open up on it, blowing it to pieces. When Jackson requested that his division commander, Brigadier General Chase Whiting, bring up his guns, Whiting protested, saying that he only had 16 of the 50 he was supposed to have. Whiting further complained that his gunners would be cut to shreds. "They won't live in there 5 minutes," said the man who had graduated first in the class of 1845 at West Point and had been Jackson's tutor in the latter's plebe year. "Obey your orders, General Whiting, promptly and willingly." Whiting, now furious, replied, "I have always obeyed my orders promptly, but will not willingly under such circumstances." The guns were brought up. It took a moment for the Union batteries to register this, and then they blew the guns, wagons, men, horses, limbers, and caisson to bits. Jackson, meanwhile, continued giving orders, in one case while a battery was being destroyed before his eyes. "He sat erect on his horse in this hurricane of canister and grape," recalled one soldier. "His face was aflame with passion, his eyes flashing." Whiting thought he was aflame with something more like madness. "Great God," he cried out to anyone listening, "won't some ranking officer save us from this fool?" Other Confederate gun crews were just as helpless before the massed counter-battery fire from the hill. After the war, McClellan's chief of artillery, Brigadier General William Barry, told Jackson's artillerist Tom Munford, chillingly, how easy it was to destroy the rebel guns. He said he had 50 pieces massed at Malvern Hill, which he could concentrate on any battery that came out in the open, and that they melted like wax under his rain of projectiles. Thus it went. By mid-afternoon, Lee decided that Longstreet's misguided barrage plan was not going to work. There would be no attack that day. Thinking ahead to a battle the following day, Lee began to move some of his reserves. He shifted some of them to be in place for the following day and left the field of battle. And then something strange and tragic happened. Earlier in the day, Lee, through his adjutant Chilton, had issued an order to all his commanders that was predicated on the idea that Longstreet's idea might work. The directive read as follows. Batteries have been established to act upon the enemy's line. If it is broken, as is probable, Brigadier General Lewis Armistead, who can witness the effect of the fire, has been ordered to charge with a yell. Do the same. Lee's orders sounded simple enough. If Armistead saw Yankees retreating from the Confederate cannon fire, he was to charge and yell, which would signal a general assault on Union lines. But the order gave no time for the attack and no time limit. The decision to advance was left to a brigadier who had never led a brigade in battle and was further distinguished for having been kicked out of West Point after an incident in which he broke a plate on Jubal Early's head. Finally, amid the din of battle, a yell, even by a full brigade, would have been inaudible to most of the men on the Confederate lines. That Lee could have even issued such an order was inexplicable. Perhaps he was exhausted. Later that day, as Jackson had the day before, he fell asleep on the field. While Jackson and D.H. Hill had concluded that an advance would be foolhardy, Sometime in late afternoon, others suddenly had different ideas about what was going to happen. First, Chase Whiting and then John Magruder sent notes to Lee, saying that parts of the Union line were retreating. Magruder, moreover, reported that Louis Armistead was driving a body of the Union forces. Neither report was true. McClellan was in no sense retreating, merely rearranging, and Armistead's minor advance had succeeded only in getting various rebel units pinned down. Lee, who was no longer on the field, for some reason credited these optimistic reports and dictated the following message to Magruder. General Lee expects you to advance rapidly. He says it is reported that the enemy is getting off. Press forward your whole line and follow up Armistead's success. Just before the late-arriving Magruder received those orders, he somehow received a copy of the earlier order from Chilton for a general advance. This was at about 5 p.m. Now, his orders were perfectly clear. He had to attack. He had to follow Armistead. So he went forward with maybe 7,000 men against the war's greatest defensive concentration. Confederate guns boomed again, and again were immediately targeted for destruction. Magruder's first attacks did nothing but sacrifice several thousand men to Federal artillery and musketry. But they had another unfortunate effect, too. They became the inadvertent signal, per the orders Chilton had delivered, for a general advance. At about 5:30, Jackson, who was commanding the D.H. Hill units, ordered those brigades forward, too. The result was pure slaughter, some of the worst of the war. To their credit, the Southern infantry did not give up. They pressed attack after attack and were badly shot up, a huge percentage of them by artillery. "It was not war, it was murder," said D.H. Hill later. Mass murder, actually. By sundown, more than 5,000 rebels had fallen, compared to 3,000 Federals. They lay on the field in one description, woven into a carpet of cold or agonized flesh. Enough of them were alive and moving to give the field a singular, crawling effect. Later burial details would report exploding corpses and pigs eating pieces of flesh that once belonged to live human beings. In their doomed attack, Lee's men had performed with extraordinary bravery. After the battle was over, Lee still did not seem to quite understand what had happened. He sought out Magruder. "General Magruder, why did you attack?" he asked. It was an odd question, considering the second, quite specific order that he had issued. Magruder replied, "In obedience to your orders," twice repeated. That night, at about 1 a.m., a group of Jackson's generals and other officers, worried that McClellan might attack in the morning, went to Jackson's headquarters, where they found him in a deep sleep. As Surgeon Hunter McGuire described it, they sat him up and shouted in his ear something about the condition of our army, its inability to resist attack, etc. Jackson, barely awake, replied, "Please let me sleep. There will be no enemy there in the morning." His officers thought he was crazy. He was right. That night the Union forces, as had become their habit, withdrew by night, again over the howls of McClellan's commanders, most notably Fitzjohn Porter and Phil Kearny, who thought he could still make a run at Richmond. "If an army can save this country," came Little Mac's canned reply, "it will be the Army of the Potomac, and it must be saved for that purpose." By the next morning, they were gone. Malvern Hill was a bloody and pointless end to the 7 days, which had seen a total of 36,463 casualties, half again more than at the Battle of Shiloh, whose killed and wounded numbers had shocked the nation. The casualties in this single week, in fact, equaled those in all the battles of the Western Theater in the first half of the year 1862, including Shiloh. It was by far the bloodiest week in the nation's history. Chapter 36, In Which Everything Changes. Though few people understood the 7 days' battles at the time, the resounding Confederate victory was a good deal more pyrrhic than it looked. There was no question that the campaign had, by its shocking implausibility, changed the war. Within a month of his appointment as commander of the Army of Northern Virginia, Robert E. Lee had turned national expectations upside down. He had driven the largest army the country had ever fielded to the banks of the James River, where it cowered and feared to come out from under mother's skirts. He had given new life to the Confederate dream of permanent, peaceful independence. But the irony here, and it was grand and tragic irony, was that Lee's counteroffensive actually marked the end of that brief, fragile period when the Union could still be preserved without making slavery the war's central issue. Without, in other words, destroying the South. From the first days of the war, the stated goals of Lincoln and Congress had been to quell the rebellion and restore the Union. Congress had been quite explicit about this. The previous summer it had passed a resolution specifically disavowing any intent to end the institution of slavery. For a time, this remained the essential position of moderate and conservative, i.e. non-radical, Republicans in the North, as well as both war and peace Democrats, neither of whom believed that freeing Southern slaves was worth spilling Union blood. Lincoln appeased the radicals in his own party and pursued his policy of fighting a war for limited ends. But by the summer of 1862, that brittle political calculus was falling apart. Lee's victory coincided with a pronounced hardening of Northern attitudes. This shift was embodied in the rise of the radical Republicans, whose beliefs included three fundamental truths: that slaves should be freed, that freeing them could only be accomplished by war, and that the nation's fate could no longer be separated from the issue of slavery. While the nominal reason for fighting continued to be suppression of the rebellion, the political winds were shifting. In January of that year, House Republican leader Thaddeus Stevens had called for total war and the emancipation of slaves. In March, Congress had forbidden U.S. Army officers from returning fugitive slaves. In April, it had abolished slavery in the District of Columbia. In June, it had prohibited slavery in the territories. And in July, it had authorized the enlistment of black soldiers and allowed for court proceedings to liberate slaves of convicted rebels. By the time of the 7 days, the ruling Republican Party itself had been radicalized. Anti-slavery bills were flooding the halls of Congress, and it was hard to find anyone in the party who still believed that simply putting the Union back together as it once existed should be the goal of the war. Though the debate raged about how exactly emancipation should happen, from gradual voluntary emancipation to compensated emancipation to outright confiscation of human property, a consensus was emerging: slavery must end. More than any leader other than Lincoln himself, McClellan was buffeted by these shifting military and political winds. He was a moderate war Democrat who wanted to end the conflict quickly and as gently as possible, with the South and its institutions fully intact. By conquering Richmond, he believed he could convince hardliners on both sides to retreat from their positions long enough to negotiate peace. If he had succeeded, it would have established him as the savior of the Union and probably would have made him president. He had, of course, failed miserably. But he held fast to his vision of a limited war. In a meeting with Lincoln on July 8, 6 days after the Battle of Malvern Hill, McClellan handed his superior an extraordinary letter. "The war," he wrote, "should not be looking to the subjugation of the people of any state. It should not be at all a war upon population, but against armed forces and political organizations. Neither confiscation of property, political executions of persons, territorial organization of states, or forcible abolition of slavery should be contemplated for a moment. All private property and unarmed persons should be strictly protected. Military power should not be allowed to interfere with the relations of servitude. A declaration of radical views, especially upon slavery, will rapidly disintegrate our present armies." The note was a superb summary of an opportunity that had already vanished by a man who had personally made it disappear. If McClellan had won at Richmond, there might well have been a negotiated peace. Robert E. Lee might never have become the hero of the South. The Union might have been put back together with a South whose economy and institutions were still intact. Lincoln might have been a one-term president. We will never know. Lincoln read the letter in McClellan's presence, amazed at the jarring impudence of this timid general who had just dragged his beaten, sick, and demoralized army into its James River camps. Lincoln made no comment. 4 or 5 months earlier, he might have agreed with McClellan, but not now. 3 weeks after the end of the 7 days' campaign, the president delivered to his cabinet the first draft of what would become known as the Emancipation Proclamation. Among other things, the document asserted that, on January 1, 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or states, wherein the constitutional authority shall not then be practically recognized, submitted to, and maintained, shall then, thenceforward and forever, be free. Lincoln was not yet ready to issue it publicly, not after McClellan's humiliation by Lee on the peninsula, but the draft was a sign of how fast the change was sweeping in. It is interesting to note, too, that however patriotic the abolitionist radicals in the North may have been, the very last thing they wanted was for Little Mac to win the battle for Richmond. Winning might have meant the preservation of slavery and the Southern way of life. With no national emergency to force the end of slavery, the abolitionists would lose their influence, and so on through a very long chain of hypothetical events. Because McClellan lost, the very thing he had wanted most was lost too. If all of this swirling change was hard to grasp, the 7 days' immediate effects were not. The Army of the Potomac was, for the moment, useless and purposeless. Lincoln, who was nearly as inconsolable as I could be and live after the Union humiliation of the 7 days, was pilloried from near and far as an ineffectual leader. "Not a spark of genius he has," thundered Henry Ward Beecher from a Brooklyn pulpit. "Not an element for leadership." Abolitionist Wendell Phillips in Boston wrote that, "He may be honest. Nobody cares whether the tortoise is honest or not. He has neither insight nor provision nor decision." The stock market fell precipitously. The price of gold rose. And, of course, the South, for the moment, saw only good coming from its victory. Britain and France, horrified by the casualty counts and impressed by Confederate military prowess, seemed more interested than ever in some sort of mediation. But that remained a fond hope and nothing more. A more likely future was suggested when on July 2, the day after McClellan's army had slunk miserably away from its victory at Malvern Hill, Lincoln, with a grim determination to finish what he started, ordered up 300,000 new volunteers. He understood that the rise of Lee and Jackson meant this was going to be a long, hard, expensive fight. The war, the new war, the actual war, was to be all about conquest, subjugation, and destruction. The immediate aftermath of Malvern Hill was pure horror, at least for the burial details that Jackson ordered out onto the killing ground. In a steady downpour and mist that hung like a shroud over the field, the men gathered and stacked the dead and pieces of the dead. Unlike most Civil War battles, in which artillery caused less than 5% of casualties, at Malvern Hill more than half of the Confederate killed and wounded had been victims of Federal solid shot, shell, spherical case, and canister. The results were ghastly. Body fragments lay everywhere. Many corpses were headless. Some were just mounds of decaying ooze that yesterday had been human beings. Jackson worked the detail, trotting up and down and hurrying the men along. When someone asked why he was in such a rush to clear the field, he replied, "Why, I'm going to attack here presently, as soon as the fog rises, and it won't do to march troops over their own dead, you know." He seemed his old hyper-aggressive self again, rested, impatient to attack. He was in favor of hot and immediate pursuit. But for the moment, that was a difficult idea. The field hospitals were jammed, the roads to Harrison's Landing had turned to muck, and no one had much of an idea exactly where McClellan was, anyway. Jackson rode to Lee's headquarters, a bullet-strafed farmhouse, to petition him. The two men were studying maps before a fire, when Confederate President Jefferson Davis, unexpected and unannounced, walked into the room with his brother, Colonel Joseph Davis. "President, I'm delighted to see you," said a surprised Lee. While Lee and a staffer chatted with the guests, Jackson, who had been sitting near the fire on the other side of the room, had risen and was standing stiffly by his chair, as though waiting for someone to notice him. Jackson had not recognized Davis at first, according to Hunter McGuire, who was with him. But when McGuire whispered the man's identity, Jackson stood as if a corporal on guard, his head erect, his little fingers touching the seams of his pants, and looked at Davis. Davis now noticed Jackson, too, and the two men stared silently at each other for a moment. Lee, realizing that Davis did not recognize Jackson, then broke in with one of the most famous introductions of the Civil War. "Why, President, don't you know Stonewall Jackson? This is our Stonewall Jackson." Then, according to McGuire, Mr. Davis started to greet him, evidently as warmly as those he had just left, but the appearance of Jackson stopped him, and when he got about a yard away, Mr. Davis halted, and Jackson immediately brought his hand up to the side of his head in military salute. Mr. Davis bowed and went back to the other company in the room. Though Jackson left no record of his thoughts, he had already had three unpleasant run-ins with Davis, and his behavior almost certainly reflected this. The first had happened at Manassas, after Davis had arrived at the battlefield and breathlessly tried to rally the troops from what he thought was a terrible defeat. Jackson, flush with victory, had loudly dismissed the president's panicky apprehensions and had vowed to march on Washington. The second was their meeting near Manassas on September 30, 1861, from which Jackson had emerged disenchanted and Davis had decided that Jackson was an overly aggressive fanatic. The third contretemps happened after Romney, when Davis allowed Jackson's orders to General Loring to be superseded by Secretary of War Judah Benjamin, an unwarranted intrusion of politics into military operations, prompting Jackson's resignation. His troubles with authority figures, from VMI Superintendent Francis Henney Smith to his Florida Superior William H. French, are well documented. Davis may have awakened some of the same uncharitable feelings in him. In any case, Jackson soon got his wish. The bloodied Army of Northern Virginia trudged forward in the heat and humidity and mud toward the Union position. When they got there, they found that it was nearly impregnable. McClellan's army was dug in on the heights overlooking the river. Behind them were the redoubtable ship-mounted guns of the Navy. Lee and Jackson agreed that there was no question of attacking. They had missed their chance to destroy the army. It was a depressing moment, made worse by the knowledge that malaria, dysentery, and typhoid were sweeping their ranks, and that sickness, death, and straggling had reduced some regiments by half. The peninsula, which seemed to the soldiers to be no more than a tangled, humid, malarial swamp, punctuated by an occasional farm field, was a miserable place to wage war. Still, Jackson wanted more. A few days later, he summoned his faithful ally, Alexander Boteler, to his camp, and once again outlined a plan. This was becoming quite familiar to Boteler by now, for an invasion of the North. He wanted Boteler to take his proposal to Richmond. In Jackson's view, the Confederacy was repeating the blunder we made after the Battle of Manassas in allowing the enemy leisure to recover from his defeat. Boteler protested that Davis would just send him back to Lee. Why didn't Jackson just speak to Lee himself? "I've already done so," Jackson replied. "Well, what does he say?" "He says nothing," Jackson said. Then quietly added, "Do not think I complain of his silence. He doubtless has good reasons for it." "Then you don't think," Boteler persisted, "that General Lee is slow in making up his mind?" "Slow," Jackson said with sudden energy, "by no means, Colonel. On the contrary, his perceptions are as quick and unerring as his judgment is infallible. But with the vast responsibilities now resting on him, he is perfectly right in withholding a hasty expression of his opinions and purposes. He then paused for a moment. So great is my confidence in General Lee that I am willing to follow him blindfolded. But I fear he is unable to give me a definitive answer now because of influences at Richmond. With that rare glimpse into Jackson's feelings about Lee, Boteler was once again dispatched. Each time Jackson proposed this idea of taking the war to the north, he sounded a little less crazy, though what he and Boteler were doing amounted to gross insubordination. In the weeks that followed the 7 days, Jackson was perfectly Jackson, self-contained, serious, hard-working, engaged with the minute details of managing his army. "He seems to have no social life," observed one soldier. "He divides his time between military duties, prayer, sleep, and solitary thought. He holds converse with few." Though his recent performance paled next to the brilliance of his Valley campaign, the more momentous Confederate success before Richmond had elevated him even higher in the popular mind. He was cheered everywhere he went. Often the cheers grew into weird, corkscrewing ululation of the rebel yell. He acknowledged the cheers by lifting his hat, then invariably spurred Little Sorrel and galloped away from all that adulation, which he believed was rightly due God and not him. He is, of course, a great military genius and has made such an impression on the men that Old Jack is at once a rallying cry and a term of endearment, wrote Cavalryman Charles Minor Blackford. The army is full of stories about him, and everybody, citizens and soldiers, is trying to get a glimpse of him. Those stories had begun to reverberate through the South. "The masses of his countrymen," wrote Allen C. Redwood, who fought with the 55th Virginia Regiment, "found something peculiarly acceptable in the character of the man, apart from his services. His retiring modesty, his indifference to display, his simple trust in the giver of all victory, were shining virtues in the eyes of a people who had only taken up arms in behalf of what they considered their dearest rights, and with no care for the pomp and circumstance of war. His very homeliness was a recommendation to the essentially practical-minded Southerner, regarding himself as the peer of any man, and constitutionally intolerant of the pretension symbolized by gold lace and other fripperies of official rank." Jackson received all sorts of gifts from these new admirers, too, in the wake of the campaign. Baskets of food arrived daily, usually intercepted by his staff, who knew he had no use for them, and were afraid they might be returned. His renown was no longer limited to the South. If Lee's attacks had been poorly orchestrated, and Jackson had been less than fearsome in some of them, those niceties were lost north of the Potomac. Indeed, one popular northern explanation of what had happened credited the victory to the onslaught of the invisible Jackson on the Union flank, sweeping in from the west, where he had left a wreckage of Union armies. In a version of this, the New York Times said inaccurately that Stonewall Jackson rushed from the valley of the Shenandoah and got in the rear of our whole army by means of a coup de guerre. Harper's Weekly marveled at his suddenness and described the furious attacks of enormous rebel armies. An editorial writer for the New York Times expressed the wish that a rumor of Jackson's death were true, because he has evinced more real genius than anybody on either side. Jackson was, for many Northerners, the embodiment of the pitiless, fanatical, religiously obsessed warrior. But for others, he was emerging not simply as a Cromwellian zealot in a cause they despised, but also as someone with qualities they otherwise might actually admire: competence, fearlessness, valor in the field, humility, and devotion to God. To his enemies, he was the strangest, most intriguing, and most threatening of all the Confederate generals. Those who had known Jackson before the war were amazed at the sheer speed of his transformation, which had raised him so far and so quickly above so many other powerful and influential people. One of the best examples involves Jackson and one of his brigadier generals, Robert Toombs. In the days just before the war began, Henry Kidd Douglas happened to see both men within days. First, he had observed Jackson in Lexington, pursuing the noiseless tenor of his way, instructing a class of mischievous cadets in natural philosophy, and almost unknown beyond the limits of that town. A few days later, Douglas happened to be in Washington, D.C., where he saw the U.S. Senator from Georgia, Robert Toombs, later one of the founding fathers of the Confederacy and its first Secretary of State, give a fiery speech on the Senate floor in favor of the acquisition of Cuba. Roughly 15 months later, Douglas and Jackson were riding through an area where the brigade commanded by Toombs was camped. Jackson noticed immediately that there were large gaps in Toombs's picket lines. He immediately rode to brigade headquarters, where he found the general lying down in the shade of a small fly tent. Jackson routed him out, and according to Douglas, directed General Toombs with some sharpness to go at once in person and make the necessary connection. Jackson then turned and rode away. This once powerful national figure was now being given curt, peremptory commands by the eccentric former physics professor. "Tempora mutantur nos et mutamur in illis," Douglas commented. "Times change, and we change with them." On that same ride, Jackson and Douglas had discovered, to Jackson's great delight, a field that was full of blackberries, one of the general's most coveted fruits. The problem was that the field was in a sort of no-man's land between federal and rebel picket lines. "And that day," wrote Douglas, "there was a deal of spiteful firing between them." Jackson went happily into the field anyway, calmly picking and eating the ripe fruit, even though, as Douglas observed, the bullets seemed to be as plentiful as blackberries. At one point he turned to his increasingly anxious aide and, with a large, juicy berry between his thumb and finger, asked Douglas casually in what part of the body I preferred being shot. Douglas, nervously handing the general berries while mini-balls whistled overhead and buried themselves in the trees around them, replied that while his first choice was to be hit in his clothing, he preferred any place other than his face or joints. Jackson said he had the old-fashioned horror of being shot in the back, and so great was his prejudice on the subject that he often found himself turning his face in the direction from which the bullets came. Just then a bullet thudded into a sapling near their heads, and Jackson, with a vague remark about getting his horse killed, reluctantly left the feast. The strange, almost recreational mood of the Blackberry Field persisted after the Confederate Army moved its camps to Richmond on July 8. Jackson's divisions were near Mechanicsville, about 3 miles from the city. The weather improved, food became better and more plentiful, and there was time to relax and write letters home. Best of all were the accolades. If Lee and Jackson were famous, so were the men who fought for them. They were aware that however it had happened, in fact they had won one battle, lost two, and fought three draws, they had done a marvelous thing. They were cheered by their compatriots. "These were the halcyon days of Jackson's troops," remembered a gunner with the Rockbridge Artillery. "Well-earned rest, good rations, abundant supplies from their valley homes, proximity to the capital with its varied attractions, the praises and admiration of its people for Stonewall and his followers, all combined to make it most pleasantly remembered ever afterwards." One infantryman remembered that Jackson gave his company permission to spend the day in Richmond. "That was a great day," he recalled. "We left Richmond a year ago in new uniforms, with the fair complexion of city men. Now we returned as veterans, ruddy and brown, with the health and hardness that outdoor living creates. Our welcome was an ovation, and it made us feel our standing in public esteem. The only thing we regretted as our time closed was that the day did not last forever." Jackson himself mostly stayed out of Richmond, attending to the mountain of administrative detail involved in running his divisions. He was a thorough and highly capable administrator, but gets little credit for it. In one of his dispatches to Ewell, you can see his thoroughness. He wants to know the condition of all his batteries, the number and kinds of guns that still worked, the number of men and serviceable horses,
which of their guns and caissons had been captured, which they had taken from the Yankees, which they had exchanged with the Yankees after the battle, and so